All right, we have a lecture first before we play with your DNA. The lecture is about gene expression. And gene expression refers to the whole process of reading a gene, using that information, and building a protein. A gene is really just a subset of the overall length of a DNA molecule. So if you think of a DNA molecule by analogy with a library, the whole DNA molecule, which is what a chromosome has, that's like one shelf of books. A gene is like just one book on that shelf. And that book instructs the cell how to make one protein. Gene expression refers to expressing the gene, meaning checking out the book, reading it, figuring out how to make the protein, and actually making the protein. So not all your genes are turned on at one time. You only turn a gene on, or you only express a gene when you need the corresponding protein for whatever it does. And gene expression, as you see in this first slide, takes place in two major steps, two major parts to gene expression, which are transcription first and then translation. And that's in any kind of cell. There's the two major kinds of cells shown here, prokaryotic cell on the top and a eukaryotic cell on the bottom. And the big difference, of course, between those types of cells is the presence or absence of the nucleus. But regardless of what kind of cell you have, gene expression happens by transcription first and then translation. And those words both start in trans, so it's easy to get them confused. Let me explain why they make sense. Transcription is the building of a molecule of RNA, a specific kind of RNA called messenger RNA, which is abbreviated mRNA, small m. And to make that messenger RNA, you need to know how to build it. Well, the DNA itself, the gene, tells the cell how to build that messenger RNA. And that's transcription. The reason that it's called transcription is because transcribe means to rewrite. Right? For instance, you order a transcript of a TV show and you get a written rewriting of what was said on that show. But in transcription, there's no change in language. It's just a rewriting. The reason it makes sense in cell terms is because the language of the gene, the DNA, is nucleic acid language. And when you rewrite that code into a new molecule, messenger RNA, you're still within the language of nucleic acids because RNA is a nucleic acid as well. Okay, so it's the code is transcribed. DNA's job at this point is done. The gene has been read, but it hasn't been fully expressed yet because you haven't made the protein yet. So now messenger RNA is carrying the code, and it's that code is written in the language of nucleic acids. So the second step is to actually build the protein, which is what translation is. And translation reads the code in the messenger RNA molecule and assembles the protein out of its subunits. What are the subunits of a protein? Amino acids, exactly. So now you're building a third molecule, but that molecule is in the language, so to speak, of amino acids, not nucleotides. So you've changed the language when you go from messenger RNA to protein, and that's why that's called translation. Right? You go to a different type of molecule or type of language by analogy. Now, since a prokaryotic cell has only one compartment, since it has only one membrane, transcription and translation both occur in the same compartment. Transcription has to occur first, or at least it has to start first, and then translation occurs. But it's all in that same one compartment that the cell has. In a eukaryotic cell, though, which has a true nucleus, it has two different compartments. It has the stuff that's in the nucleus, which collectively is called the nucleoplasm, and it has all the stuff outside of it, which is collectively called the cytoplasm. Well, transcription has to occur wherever the DNA is. In a eukaryotic cell, that DNA is in the nucleus. So transcription in a eukaryotic cell, it has to occur in the nucleus. Translation has to occur at the organelles that are responsible for building the proteins, which are ribosomes. Those little brown dots that we saw in other pictures. Well, ribosomes are out in the cytoplasm. So in a eukaryotic cell, transcription has to occur in the nucleus, and then the messenger RNA that's created out of that needs to be transported through the nuclear envelope out into the main compartment, the cytoplasm, where it can meet up with a ribosome for translation to occur. And so in this cartoon, the red ribbon is the messenger RNA. That's carrying the code telling this little brown ribosome how to build the protein, meaning how many total amino acids there will be and which specific one of the 20 amino acids will be in each position. So it's like building a necklace out of 20 different kinds of beads, and it has a certain number of beads. That's what the purple thing is. A polypeptide is a protein. It's one strand of amino acids. Okay? By the way, a polypeptide is called a polypeptide because the kinds of bonds holding two amino acids together, forming a longer chain, that bond is called a peptide bond. And if you string together a bunch of amino acids, you have a bunch of peptide bonds. Therefore, the whole thing is called a polypeptide. Okay, slide 2. Top box shows you part of a DNA molecule. Now, one long, enormously long DNA molecule, which is what's in one chromosome, is, like I said last time, millions of nucleotides long. And it can contain thousands of genes. So we're looking at just a little segment here. But notice that genes are just little subsegments of the length of that DNA. So they themselves are just nucleotide sequences. But also, there's a bunch of DNA between genes that is not coding for how to make proteins. It does other stuff, some of which we don't know, and some of which might be no function at all. But there's long stretches of DNA between each of your genes. And in fact, only about 1% of your overall DNA is in genes. You have long sequences of what are called non-coding regions between genes. So you have three genes just shown for example here, and gene 1, a little bit of gene 1, is shown in detail here. So this isn't even the entire gene, it's just part of the sequence of this gene. And the double helix has been untwisted, so you see it as a ladder, right? Remember the anti-parallel nature of the two strands, they're head to tail basically. And you have the A's, C's, T's, and G's listed. That's the specific sequence of the gene. Well, that specific sequence is the code. Genes are different because they have different sequences, and they therefore specify different arrangements of amino acids, different proteins, to be made. But like I said, it's not a direct process. DNA is not used directly to make proteins. DNA is used directly to make messenger RNA. And then messenger RNA is used directly to make proteins. So in the first of the two steps, transcription, to read the code in the DNA, in the gene, you have to separate the two strands, like I said. In this case, well, there's two strands, and they're complementary to each other, but either one of them could actually be carrying the code. One of them is called the template strand, and in this example, it happens to be this strand, but in the next gene, it could be the bottom strand that's considered to be the template strand. Anyway, there's a template strand in each gene, and the other strand, once it's removed, it's basically ignored during this process. Once you're done reading the gene, the two will be sewn back together by hydrogen bonds again. But this non-template strand really isn't used in the process of transcription. It's just one of the two strands. So the reason that a cell is able to know how to build a messenger RNA molecule by reading a gene is that the messenger RNA molecule uses the same complementarity rules that DNA itself does. So notice that the code here is ACCAAACCGAGT on the DNA. RNA is just like DNA, except that instead of using thymine, which DNA uses, RNA uses a different nitrogenous base in its place called uracil. Uracil, or U, is what RNA has. RNA doesn't have any T's in it, it only has U's, but it also has A's, C's, and G's, just like DNA. So, this A in the DNA, complementarily, if you were talking about DNA, would be a T, right? But if you're making RNA instead, which uses U's instead of T's, you get a U. C corresponds to G, C to G, A to normally T, but U, and so on. So the sequence of the gene specifies the sequence of nucleotides to make this messenger RNA. And that's what transcription is. It builds the RNA molecule one nucleotide at a time by putting the correct ones together after reading the original sequence in the gene. Okay, DNA's job is done. This messenger RNA now needs to go to a ribosome, one of those little brown dots in the cell picture, and it binds to the ribosome so that the ribosome basically can read this sequence now, the messenger RNA sequence. Now, the simplest, the goal here in translation is to build the polypeptide, the correct polypeptide specified by the messenger RNA sequence. And so the ribosome needs to know which of the 20 amino acids to put down first, which of the 20 amino acids to put down second, and so on, for however many amino acids long the polypeptide needs to be. So the simplest possibility would be to just have every different nucleotide in messenger RNA specify a different amino acid. Right? One nucleotide specifies one amino acid. What's the problem with that? It's the simplest solution, and therefore evolution would have favored it, but it was impossible for that to work. Why? Why can't you have one nucleotide specify one amino acid?
Then there would only be 2 to 4 different types of amino acids.
There would be 4, exactly, because there's 4 nucleotides. Right? There's U, C, A, and G. U, C, A, and G. That means you would only, if you had a one-to-one correspondence, you would only be able to use 4 kinds of amino acids. Well, there's 20 kinds of amino acids that cells use to build their proteins. So you can't possibly have such a simple solution to the coding problem. You understand what I'm saying here? I can wait. Okay. Well, therefore you need to have, since there aren't as many nucleic acid types or nitrogenous base types as there are amino acid types, you need to use more than one nucleotide to represent an amino acid. Therefore, the next simplest solution is to use 2. But if you use 2, how many combinations are there? There's 16 possibilities, 4 squared. 4 possibilities for the first position times 4 possibilities for the second position. Well, 16 is still less than 20, so that doesn't do the job either. Therefore, the simplest possible way that will work is exactly the way that it does work, because evolution favors the simplest method. And therefore, it takes 3 RNA nucleotides to stand for one amino acid. And that sequence of three nucleotides within the messenger RNA is called a codon, because it codes for one amino acid. Now, how many different combinations are there if you use a sequence of three nucleotides?
64.
Right. 4 cubed. 4 times 4 times 4, which is 64. Way more than the 20 that you need, but it's the smallest number that you need to get all 20 of them specified. All right? So translation now reads, the ribosome reads the messenger RNA one codon at a time, but that means three nucleotides at a time. And so each codon, each triplet, which is a sequence of three nucleotides, specifies its own amino acid. And so TRP, that's just one of the 20 amino acids. Tryptophan, phenylalanine, glycine, serine, and so on. That gets you the specific protein that the gene originally is coding for. Okay? That's translation.
Okay, so if there's 64 possible amino acids, but there's only...
No, 64 possible codons.
All right, so there's 64 possible codons. Is it possible to build proteins and amino acids that we haven't seen before?
Well, it is if we designed the cellular machinery to do that. Or it is if we build a protein completely abiotically, just chemically, rather than using a cell to do it. Yeah, and that's and that's because, like I said last time, there's, well, I think I've said this, maybe I didn't. There's not just 20 amino acids in the world. There's 20 that cells use. In the laboratory, you could design any amino acid you want, and therefore, putting them together, you could make any protein you want. But cells use the same set of 20 amino acids, which is one of the strong bits of information indicating that we all come from a common ancestor. Bacteria, elephants, sequoia trees, whatever, yeast, they all use the same 20 amino acids. We're all related. We all came from that original cell billions of years ago. Now, this table shown on slide 3 is the genetic code. And I stress the word the. It's the genetic code because it's universal. This is another strong bit of evidence that we all come from the same common ancestor. All organisms use the same genetic code to build their proteins. Okay? So when you change species, they don't use different codons to represent different amino acids. They use the same ones we do. And the table shows all 64 possible combinations of three nucleotides. In other words, all 64 possible codons. Those are the all cap letters. And then to the right of each triplet or codon is a three-letter abbreviation for the specific kind of amino acid that that codon stands for. All right, so phenylalanine, leucine, and so on. I don't want you to memorize the types of amino acids, but that's what those upper and lowercase mixtures represent, the amino acids themselves. I just got done saying that there are 64 codons, but it only has to stand for 20 amino acids. So you have more than you need of codons, and therefore you can double or even triple or more up. In other words, what I'm trying to say is the genetic code has two very important properties. It is redundant, but it is not ambiguous. All right, so let's make sure everyone knows what I'm saying by this. What does it mean to be redundant? Yeah, you're repetitive. Like when people say very unique, which I hear all the time and makes me cringe. Unique means that there's only one. So there's no degrees of uniqueness. All right? Uni means one. So you're not very unique. You're either unique or not. But anyway, that's redundant. In terms of the genetic code, redundancy comes from the fact that you have 64 codons to work with, but you only need 20 codes. So some... some amino acids are specified by more than one codon. Like leucine, for instance. Notice that there's six different codons, each of which means leucine is the correct amino acid here. And so it doesn't matter which of these codons you use, you still add leucine when you build the protein. And in language, this is analogous to synonyms. There's a lot of different ways to say the same thing. There's a lot of different words for good, for instance. Right? Good, great, tremendous, fantastic, stupendous, blah, blah, blah. That's redundancy. But I said that despite being redundant, it is not ambiguous. So first of all, what does it mean to be ambiguous? In everyday language. What is ambiguity? Anyone? Are you just sitting there or you actually just don't know? Okay. To be ambiguous is to be unclear because there are multiple possible meanings. Okay? So, for instance, if I say I'm hot, that could mean that my temperature is elevated. It could mean that I'm extremely angry. It could mean that I'm the most popular celebrity at the moment. Or it could mean that I'm sexually attractive. Or maybe more. Now, probably you're thinking sexually attractive one. But if I say that, I could be mistaken because of ambiguity. You don't want that to be the case in the genetic code. In other words, you don't want a codon to be interpreted sometimes as one amino acid and different times as a different amino acid. Otherwise, when you go read that book the next time, you might be making a totally different protein, which won't work for the cell. So that you don't want the genetic code to be ambiguous. You want it to be definitely clear each time it's read. So that means that even though there's redundancy, multiple codons can stand for the same amino acid, each individual codon always specifies the same amino acid. That's non-ambiguity. Okay? Everyone understand that? Now notice that there's four codons in these 64 that are shaded. That's because they have a special role. The green one here, AUG, it stands for methionine, so every time it comes up in the sequence, it tells the ribosome, put a methionine amino acid here. But it also has double duty as what's called the start codon. So it's the code that the ribosome looks for to say, okay, this is the beginning of the code. Start here. And then there's three in orange here that each operates as a stop codon. And so that's redundancy as well. There doesn't matter which stop codon is encountered. When the ribosome reads a stop codon, any one of these three, it says, okay, I'm at the end. Stop building the protein. It's done. Okay? Let's go to slide 4 and look at these two photographs of unusual organisms. You have a tobacco plant on the left and a pig on the right, and both of them are glowing. So this is not just a Photoshop doctoring of the photograph. They are actually glowing, which is unusual for these organisms. Some organisms glow, but these ones naturally do not. And the reason they're able to is because of biotechnology. Through biotechnology, we're able to put genes into these two organisms that have been taken from a different organism that does naturally glow. We do that when they're still just one cell, and then they grow into a multicellular adult. And so they keep copying that new gene that's been inserted into them, so now their whole body has that gene. And therefore, they glow just like the original donor organism glows. This one was taken from a firefly or lightning bug, depending on which part of the country you come from. And this, the pig gene came from a jellyfish. All right? Now, by the way, this whole pig is glowing, not just the nose and the tips. It just looks like it's glowing, but only in certain places because there's no hair there. The hair is not glowing, but the living cells are. Okay, The reason that this is possible, because neither of these organisms really was born to glow, right? The reason that they're able to glow, though, the reason that they're able to interpret that gene that has no natural business being in their body is because of the universality of the genetic code. The genetic code is the genetic code. It's the same rules for all organisms. So if you find a way to get a gene from some organism into some other organism, it will treat that gene just like it does its own natural genes. It'll read it and obey the same genetic code and make the same kind of protein.
So if we wanted to, we can glow?
Yeah.
No way.
Yeah, we could. Remember I said a while ago that it's your proteins that actually give you your characteristics. But you're only able to make a certain number of proteins, which depends on which genes you have. Well, if we change what genes you have, now all of a sudden you can make proteins that you never made before, and therefore you have new characteristics. That's what happened here. Okay, slide 5. Gene expression occurs at a ribosome. Translation occurs at a ribosome, translation is just the second stage of gene expression. And translation, remember, is the actual assembly of the protein out of the amino acids it's made of. And messenger RNA is holding the code. That's the red ribbon here. And a ribosome, a single ribosome, really is made up of two subunits, a large subunit and a small subunit, that come together and kind of clamp the messenger RNA between them. All right? And there are 3 slots on this ribosome. The one on the right in this picture is where things come in. The one on the left is where things go out. And those things that are coming in or going out, which are these teal-colored bent rods in this cartoon, those are a different kind of RNA that's involved in this process called transfer RNA, or tRNA. tRNA's job is to carry amino acids, right? So on this right slot here, which is the, let me see, do I have a good picture? Well, yeah, okay. These tRNA molecules, notice that they are floating around in the cytoplasm. Each one, though, is carrying a specific kind of amino acid. So there are different kinds of transfer RNA molecules corresponding to the different kinds of amino acids. And each kind of transfer RNA is only able to carry its specific kind of amino acid. That's what makes for non-ambiguity. It makes sure that when the certain codon is read, exactly the right amino acid will come in. But you have all kinds of tRNAs carrying the different kinds of amino acids, and therefore you need a way for just the right one to be able to come to this slot in the ribosome. And the way the cell makes sure that the right kind of tRNA comes in, carrying the correct kind of amino acid, is that the codon in the messenger RNA specifies which kind of tRNA is allowed in. Now the tRNA molecule, even though it is drawn here as a peg, it is an RNA molecule. So it itself is a sequence of nucleotides. Only 3 of those nucleotides are shown here, though. And those 3 nucleotides are called the anticodon. All right? An anticodon is part of a tRNA molecule, whereas the codon is part of the mRNA molecule. But each codon has a corresponding anticodon. The anticodon is complementary to the codon. And in this example, notice that the codon that's being read currently is GGC. Therefore, the complementary sequence, C for G, and G for C. So the anticodon, the correct anticodon, would have to be CCG. Okay? Now, there's all kinds of tRNAs that have CCG as their anticodon. Plus, there's all kinds of other tRNA molecules with other anticodons. But all of the CCG anticodon tRNAs are carrying glycine and only glycine. That's the only kind of amino acid those ones are allowed to carry. Therefore, if GGC is read as part of the messenger RNA, that means the amino acid that's being brought in has to be glycine. And when you look up GGC in the genetic code I just showed you, it says glycine is the amino acid that's correct here. Okay? That's how the ribosome correctly assembles the right polypeptide. But notice that this tRNA that's in the middle slot, it is connected to a whole string of amino acids. This growing strand is not yet done. But this tRNA that this strand is connected to, this tRNA used to be one just like the one coming in on the right. It was carrying just one amino acid. And then the one that's being injected here on the left, it was carrying all of them up to TRP. Then it handed off to the one that's bringing in PHE, it handed off all the rest of them, making it one amino acid longer. Now the same thing's going to happen again. A new tRNA carrying GLY is coming in, and this whole strand is going to be transferred to this one. So that elongates the polypeptide, makes it one more amino acid long. That makes sense? Let's look at the detail of this in slide 6. There's really three phases to translation. Initiation, elongation, and termination. So initiation gets it, I don't really have a picture for that, but that is where it starts. It reads that first codon, puts things into place, assembles the ribosome. Elongation is shown here in slide 6. And we've already started the process because already four amino acids have been added. That's why there's four amino acids attached to that P slot transfer RNA. By the way, notice that the slots are labeled A, P, and E. I read them in that direction because that's the direction, that's the order in which they work. A first, then P, then E. The A slot stands for aminoacyl tRNA binding site. The P slot stands for peptidyl tRNA binding site. Okay? So a tRNA can be any given tRNA, can be in any of three different configurations. It can be uncharged, which means that it's not carrying anything. And that's what you see right here, this one that's coming out of the E slot. By the way, the E slot stands for exit. A, P, and E. The one coming off this exit, that's an uncharged tRNA because it's not carrying anything. No amino acid. A charged tRNA is carrying at least one amino acid, but there's two possibilities. A charged tRNA can be carrying just one amino acid, like the one that's coming in at the top. And that's called an aminoacyl tRNA because all it is carrying is one amino acid. All right? Or it can be like the middle one on the P slot, carrying multiple amino acids strung together. Well, multiple amino acids strung together are a polypeptide. So a tRNA that's attached to a polypeptide is called a peptidyl tRNA. Okay? Those are the three possibilities. Well, the peptidyl tRNA that's in the middle at the top here, that's already carrying all the amino acids that have been strung together so far. This is the current codon being read at the A slot, so that allows just this kind of tRNA to come in, which brings just the right kind of amino acid. So that one that's coming in is an aminoacyl tRNA, and therefore it goes into the A slot. Now you have transfer of all these first four amino acids to the one, to the next one that's being brought in. And so that really turns this one that's in the P slot at the moment into an uncharged tRNA. And it turns this one that's in the A slot, which was just a second ago an aminoacyl tRNA, turns it into a peptidyl tRNA because it's carrying many. But then everything shifts one codon to the right. So these tRNAs shift to the left, basically. And that puts this uncharged tRNA into the E, or exit slot, and it gets removed. It puts the one that's carrying the peptide, the strand, into the P slot, and it leaves the A slot empty for the next aminoacyl tRNA to come in, whichever codon is specifying it. Does this make any sense? Okay, now the uncharged one that's ejected, that just has to go back and be charged by its, with its correct kind of amino acid, so that it can then, when it's called again, bring in that kind of amino acid. So the tRNAs are just recycled, but they, each different kind of tRNA always is only able to carry its specific kind of amino acid based on its anticodon. Yeah.
Does it always progress from a 5' end to a 3' end?
Yeah, that's an important point, but I'm not actually going to get into it for this class. But it is always that direction, yes. Okay, and these GTPs that are in the little action balloons, those are energy-carrying molecules which are spent in this process because building a protein is expensive. Why? What part of metabolism is the building of a protein? Anabolism. Yes, anabolic processes require energy. Catabolic processes, breaking things down, release energy. So that's why we eat. We break down those big molecules, get energy out of the process so that we can build up our own molecules in our own cells. All right, that's elongation, second part of translation. And slide 7 shows you termination, which just is when it gets to the end. Remember, there's three different stop codons in the genetic code. Doesn't matter which one comes up, but when a stop codon comes up at the A slot, there's no corresponding tRNA. Instead, a special protein shown in yellow here, called a release factor, is what comes in to the A slot. And that tells the ribosome, okay, we've already added the last amino acid. The polypeptide is done. So it's at the moment, it's still connected to this peptidyl tRNA that's in the P slot. But the release factor says everything needs to be disintegrated now except for the strand itself. The strand is released. It's now a free polypeptide. It's a protein on its own. And the whole ribosome complex and the mRNA dissociate from each other. Okay? The process is complete. Now, if you need another one of those proteins, you can another ribosome can clamp onto the same messenger RNA as long as it's still around, and you'll make an exact copy of the protein because you're going to be using the same code again. Eventually, the messenger RNA molecule itself will be broken down by the cell. You don't want a messenger RNA molecule to hang around forever because for as long as it's around, ribosomes are going to still make that protein. Well, you don't need that protein forever. You don't want to make a protein which is expensive to build unless you need it. Therefore, they get these messenger RNA molecules get broken down. And if later on you need the protein again, you just go back to the DNA library, transcribe a new messenger RNA, and then translate new proteins. Okay, the final slide here shows you the effect of mutation. A mutation is a change in the sequence of DNA. Change in DNA nucleotide sequence. So you have a certain sequence that you got from the cells, you know, that you got from your parents, basically. But every time your own cells split into two new cells, they need to copy that DNA. And anywhere in the lifetime of a cell, accidents can occur. Mutations are just random accidents, but they're accidents that result in the sequence of DNA nucleotides being changed somehow. Well, we don't see much of the sequence of the gene here. This happens to be a gene that is responsible for making hemoglobin, which is a protein in your blood that carries oxygen around, and carbon dioxide. But anyway, this whole gene is many codons long. We're only seeing one codon within the gene here. Notice it's three nucleotides long. And the left version is the normal or wild type version, the kind that most humans have. In the right side, we have a mutant version. If a mutation occurs, there's a change in the sequence. In this case, that middle T of CTT gets turned into an A instead. Or I shouldn't say it gets turned into it. When the cell makes the new DNA, instead of putting down CTT as the copy, it makes a mistake and puts down CAT instead. Well, that's what gives you your original DNA. But then, when your cells make you multicellular by splitting, accidents can occur during that time. Okay, but yes, you receive you can receive whatever your parents do, and so your parents could give you the mutant version, or they could give you the wild type version, depending on your parents. But the point here is that mutations, which are just changes in DNA, affect the proteins you're able to make, because the DNA indirectly stands for what kind of protein you're able to construct. So if you look at CTT in, well, you don't have to look at anything. CTT in the DNA, which is the normal type, that would make an RNA molecule that's GAA, complementary to CTT, right? C becomes G, T becomes A, T becomes A. And then if you look up GAA in the genetic code, it says glutamic acid is the amino acid you should add here. So that is the normal amino acid of the several amino acids in the protein that occupies this position. In the mutant version, though, CAT makes GUA in the messenger RNA instead of GAA. And if you look up GUA, that's a different codon. It specifies a different amino acid, valine instead. So the rest of this protein, even in the mutant person, is correct. It's just this one bead in the necklace that's wrong. But that makes a big difference, and that, in this specific case, gives the person sickle cell disease, which is a drastic reduction in the ability of the hemoglobin to carry oxygen. All right? So that's how mutation works. Well, mutation is a random mistake, so usually it's either neutral or bad for the organism. But every once in a while, just a random mistake actually makes a better version of a protein, just randomly. And when it makes a better version, those get passed on to the next generation with greater frequency because the organisms survive better, have a better chance of mating and passing those on. Well, that's how things speciate. That's why there are different kinds of organisms. That's how evolution works, by mutation. Okay, let's take a quick break and then come back so we have time to get our DNA made.